You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse and WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings.
You might have had a run-in with the law and wondered about your rights. I sure did. You might wonder how law enforcement deals with gangs. You might wonder how it is that the President of the United States gets away with everything from lying to tax evasion. Or maybe you wonder why Ed Pawlowski got 15 years while his sidekick, the maker of the mess, got 5. How about the white rednecks stockpiling semi-automatic weapons just waiting to be sprayed randomly into a crowd? Tonight my guest has all the answers. He is retired federal prosecutor and current adjunct professor at DeSales University. His name is Seth Weber. Welcome, Seth.
Welcome. Thank you, Alan.
We've got about 3 hours worth of material to talk about, and we've got an hour to do it. I want to just say to the listeners that I got to know Seth when he was when he prosecuted a pretty massive conspiracy to commit fraud in the Center City Allentown housing market. The victims were almost entirely Latino and African American. It goes back to the early years of this century, believe it or not. And it was the kind of thing that led to the 2007 meltdown of the economy. I remember being in a meeting with Alan Greenspan, then the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and telling him that what was going on in the mortgage market was a disaster, given my own experience with some of the fraud that we experienced. And I remember him saying, well, I'm a libertarian when it comes to credit issues. The market will work itself out. It did, of course, and largely because it collapsed and the money dried up. But it was just a disastrous experience. And a lot of the things that I want to talk about tonight come from that. But also, you might recognize Seth's name from news accounts of the Pawlowski case when he was the key source for the news media seeking to interpret what was happening in the newsroom. I mean, in the courtroom, sorry. So, Seth, let's get right into it. Let's first ask how you became a federal prosecutor. What drove you there?
Sure. It was not the straight line route. I didn't watch a lot of cop shows. I didn't watch FBI stuff.
Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. didn't inspire you?
I did watch that show every now and then, actually, the FBI. But I was a long-haired rock musician in high school and had a high school internship with the Teaneck Police Department in Teaneck, New Jersey. I had long hair down to my shoulders, and I thought, wouldn't this be cool to work with the police department? They can't make me cut my hair, and I can get a project out of it. And so that's what I did, and it actually got me interested in police work and the law.
Well, you know, what's really kind of odd about that is that the counterculture revolution was, I mean, they were pigs, right? I mean,
pigs.
And I remember using that term frequently. I was stopped, I don't know how many times. I learned fairly quickly that when you get caught, you better smarten up, you better suddenly learn respect, you better treat the police carefully. And you know, try to keep yourself out of the courtroom. I was arrested 3 times before I was 22 years old. 2 of them were juvenile. But so, I mean, from my experience as also a hippie, you know, I would have gone, you know, hightailing it in a different direction. So it's interesting because didn't they do drug tests in those days? I mean, if you were a serious hippie, you would have been smoking pot like I was.
Well, you know, you got to make compromises sometimes. And, yeah, of course, you know, you brought out all the bad things that people think about cops and did think back then. But, of course, there's all the good stuff. If your house gets broken into, if you get assaulted, I mean, the first people you call, the police.
Yeah.
And they're there to help you no matter what.
Believe me, I turned around big time. I want so badly to be a hero at some point in my life, you know, that I have tremendous admiration for the police, for the firefighters, all the first responders. I mean, maybe it was 2000, not September 11th, but I mean, those guys just do, you know, incredibly heroic work, and so I'm with you on that. I converted at some point along the way.
Right.
So keep going.
So that got me started working with the police department. I worked at Teaneck Police for about 3 years, and then somebody said, "Well, why don't you go to law school?" And I said, "Well, okay, I guess I'll take the law boards." So I took the law boards and became a lawyer. Went to Rutgers undergraduate in New Brunswick, and then I got to Temple Law School. Which brought me to Pennsylvania. My first job out of law school was as an assistant public defender in Bucks County. Then I became an assistant DA in Bucks County. And then someone said, "You should become a federal prosecutor." I said, "What's that?" I hadn't even heard of the U.S. Attorney's Office back then. And yeah. I became an assistant U.S. attorney in Philadelphia and stayed there for 26 years.
So you went to law school, but they didn't teach about federal law enforcement issues?
They had offers of courses in federal courts and federal jurisdiction and federal law, and I took none of them because I knew I was going to be a DA. I was, you know, from the police department, and I said, I want to be a prosecutor and make sure bad people stay behind bars. So I was going to be a prosecutor. Why'd I have to know federal law?
Well, so it wasn't one Adam 12. It wasn't
I mean, wasn't the Rookies.
Ironside.
And Hill Street Blues.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hill Street Blues.
Right.
I think you're about the same. Class of 76 in high school?
How about class of 71?
Oh, man.
Yeah,
Seth looks
I
much better
old.
Than I do. You're dressed nice for a radio, by the way. Thanks very much. So what I learned was that the FBI investigates and the prosecutors prosecute. So when we did that big fraud case, I dealt with you and I dealt with the FBI and was fascinated by the whole experience. I spent a lot of time, literally a few years, trying to get somebody in official places to acknowledge that, you know, these people were preying on poor people and taking advantage of their language disparity, you know, and things like that. And the FBI, I mean, nobody wanted it. I mean, I went to Congress, I went to the Fannie Mae, I went to the State Department of Banking. One of my best friends from college was the chief counsel to the Bureau of Occupational Affairs, which regulated the appraisers who were key to the equation. He did nothing, couldn't do anything. Finally, we sat with Jim Martin, who was still the DA. He was the DA back then,
right.
And he connected us to the FBI. And the rest from as they say, is history. We'll come back to that. So in 27 years, how many cases did you get? I mean, is that hundreds of cases, or is that 27? Or
it's probably thousands of cases.
Oh,
I looked at my job as, you're a prosecutor, you're supposed to protect people. And so when agents brought me a case, my answer was, yes, I'll take the case. If it was a good case, great, we tried to make it a little better. If there was no case, but there should be, I said, go out, do some more investigation, get me some more evidence, and we'll take the case.
And that was as a DA as well as?
Same as with the DA's office in Bucks County. I tried probably over 50 jury trials in 3 years that I was with the Bucks County DA's office, and I probably tried 70 cases as an assistant U.S. attorney.
Hmm. So is there any case, or are there a few cases that stand out for you in terms of the role you played and the significance and your personal interest and all that?
Well, there were the murder cases, obviously, where, you know, somebody dies. There's victims there. And then you have to be sure the person that's charged is the one that committed the crime, and you want to make sure that person is found guilty. You're the voice for the deceased person. If you don't do it, no one will.
So, but you were 27 years as a federal prosecutor, correct?
Right.
what about, I mean, federal prosecutors, don't frequently go after murder cases, right?
No. Federal prosecutors primarily focus on white-collar crime. So those are the crimes that involve financial loss, money, rather than physical harm. And a lot of people in the country think white-collar crime, well, who cares? I mean, Bernie Madoff, 20-year Ponzi scheme, $50 billion. Uh-huh. But that's not affecting me. What affects me is my neighbor's house got broke into or somebody broke into my car.
Yeah.
So white-collar crime was always a little more difficult to prove.
So does the U.S. does the prosecuting attorney pick the cases that to go after and instruct the investigative side, or does the investigative side find stuff and bring it to the federal prosecutors?
I'd say both. So the U.S. Attorney's Office, federal prosecutors, do not investigate crimes. We rely on the FBI. We rely on DEA if it's a drug case, the EPA if it's an environmental crime, ATF if there's guns involved. So the agencies do the investigation. They bring it to us. The great thing about being a federal prosecutor is that we have discretion. We can determine, is there enough evidence here in this case to bring it, or do we really need some more? Go back, get me some more stuff, and then we'll take the case.
So, this is, if you prosecuted thousands of cases, for crying out loud, you're probably going to have a hard time remembering some of the details of the case that I brought you. But as I said, I had a hard time finding anybody to pay attention to it. Eventually, Jim Martin said, yep, I think you got something here. I think I can connect you to the FBI. He brings us in to meet with the FBI, and we laid out the case. I had settlement sheets, HUD-1 settlement sheets. I had, how people were connected to each other and the conspiracy. We could name names like crazy. And I remember just as plain as you sitting here today that at some point the FBI agent said, you've got a crime here. This is clearly a crime. But the next question totally blew me away, and it's part of what I want to talk to you about today. The next question was, how many victims are there? What's the extent of the damage? And so I could show him that we thought there were easily 200 cases. And that was enough to get him to say, "We let's pursue this." What I've wondered about is how many would have been acceptable? If these people were smart enough to say, I think we've made enough money ripping these people off. Let's quit while the quitting's good. Would they have had to quit at 50, 100? 200 clearly made the grade. But what would have, do you have any sense of how do you make that decision on whether or not the crime is worthy of your attention?
Yeah, I'd have to answer that by the answer to most questions in law, which is, it depends.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right. He told you, or she told you, the FBI agent, that it was a crime. You would think it stops there, but it doesn't. The next question was, how many victims? And the reason that question is asked is because it costs a lot of money to prosecute a federal case. So they just want to make sure. If there were two victims or 10 victims, the U.S. attorneys, the FBI might say, look, why don't you take it to the local DA's office? They could prosecute it as well as us. And, there's just it would cost us way too much money. Hundreds of victims? Yeah, we got that.
So at the time, the U.S. attorney was Pat Meehan, who eventually went to Congress. And oddly enough, his niece was my daughter's roommate at LaSalle University, which just was another one of those small world crazy things. But Pat said to me that his priorities were, as you said, white-collar crime, gun incidents, and predatory lending. Now, Pat Meehan was a Republican, probably still is. Maybe not, given who the president is, but he was appointed by a Republican, George W., and he cared about an issue that us liberals thought nobody on that side of the aisle cared about because people were making money and that's what matters, So the U.S. attorney had enough discretion to make that kind of broad policy decision or, if you will, a priority and is that the case in U.S. attorneys all across the country? They get to pick the issues that matter, that are of greatest interest?
Well, the answer to the question is yes. I mean, the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, will give guidelines as to certain priority cases that we're going to look at. So, you know, homeland security type cases, domestic terrorism, international terrorism, white collar crime, drug gangs, whatever they pick. And then you can have broad discretion within those categories. Mm. And so in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I can tell you that in 26 years, politics almost never reared its ugly head. If there was a crime and there was sufficient amount of harm done to a sufficient number of victims, or even one victim, really, we would take that case.
You know, I'm an amateur at this job that I've got right now with you, Seth. I keep forgetting that people need to know that they're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. This is Lehigh Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Alan Jennings, the host of the show, along with Seth Weber, a retired federal prosecutor and currently adjunct faculty.
Adjunct faculty at DeSales, teaching undergraduate criminal justice courses, and an adjunct professor of law at Villanova Law School.
Wow. Okay. They went after the case. I handed over all kinds of records from, you know, I was knocking on people's doors and getting their settlement sheets and finding this blatant, obvious, you know, formula for committing fraud. And if you remember, you know, all the time we spent together working on that case, I was really frustrated at the end because you guys only went after three of what I thought were easily 15 co-conspirators. There were guys that were, I'm not going to name them, I'll keep the radio station out of trouble, but there were brokers who were fixing the deals. There were appraisers who were fraudulently inflating values. There was a title search company that did every single one of the transactions, so they had to know something was going on. There was a homeowner's insurance agent that was doing all of the insurance. And yet we only went after three guys. And the most amazing thing was, as you remember, I was the only person that was there to testify at the sentencing hearing for the prosecution. And they wanted to use those guys who should have been busted too as character witnesses for the guys being prosecuted. You remember that?
I do remember that.
I mean, talk about, you know, irony. That just blows me away.
People who should have been defendants are now character witnesses.
Yeah, right. I mean, just unbelievable. So my understanding was, go ahead.
We had to pick and choose. You're right. There are lots of other people that could have been defendants in the case. The question is, we're going to take the case. We want to go from the top down, and we did. We got the president of the company. We got the vice president. We got the chair, the director or chief of mortgage broker there. So we got them all, and we put them out of business. We closed the mortgage company that was located in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Right.
So we did what we could.
And hopefully you sent a message to other perpetrators, and communities elsewhere, right? I mean,
yes. I mean, I personally did two other mortgage fraud cases, one in Delaware County and one in another county. So, yeah, people were getting the word that the U.S. Attorney's Office, if we get information about mortgage fraud, we're going to go after it, and we're going to try to put you in jail and put you out of business.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. I've got Seth Weber with me, a friend who did some great work working for the government. We're going to take a short break. Stick around. There's a lot more to talk about with Seth Weber.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100, extension 7, or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. Glad you're with us. This is Alan Jennings, host of Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. My guest tonight, federal prosecutor. Man, that sounds like such a federal prosecutor. You know, you can't be a wimp and be a federal prosecutor. So my guest tonight is Seth Weber, federal prosecutor. And so the next thing is a more recent case. Our dog died one day, and my wife and I were both home to deal with the dog's passing. And when we did, I decided to go back to work, and my wife stayed home. So we got home from work that evening, and we're talking and chatting, and eventually she says, "Oh, by the way, the FBI was here to see you." I'm like, "By the way, the FBI?" She said, "Well, you know, with you, it's a thrill every day, you know?" So indeed, a federal, Bureau of Investigation agent was knocking at my door. And you know what he wanted to talk about? He wanted to talk about my friend, the former mayor of Allentown, Ed Pawlowski. And that case, really, I mean, there was so much about it. And I thought you commented in a way that was pretty fair and even-handed. And it was hard for me to judge whether you thought he was guilty or not based on what you knew and what you were reading. But I wasn't exactly sure of it. So, because my experience was, I mean, every witness that appeared in that courtroom was asked if they heard Ed Pawlowski agree to a deal and in any form deliver. And every one of them said they had not. So it seemed to me that there was a lot of circumstantial stuff there. And yet we've got a guy who's spending 15 years, theoretically, behind bars. I don't know if he has actually bars in it because he's in a minimum security facility. Was he guilty from your perspective?
Well, my perspective doesn't matter. That's sure the beauty of the jury system. And, you know, he had what our Constitution requires, a jury of his peers. And let me tell you, Alan, getting a jury of 12 people who come from all different walks of life, who don't know each other, to agree
on something, anything,
what movie they want to watch, what television show they like.
Whether the sun rises in the east or not.
Exactly. But, you know, they came together in this case, and a unanimous verdict, which is required, found him guilty on just about, you know,
44 of 47 or something like that?
Yeah, 47 of like 53 counts. So I would have to say if the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt he was guilty, then he's guilty.
Pretty guilty. Yeah, so, you know, from my experience with what happened in the mortgage fraud case, where I thought it was pretty clear there were 15-plus people that were part of the conspiracy and, quote, guilty, and how that was handled as opposed to both guns blazing on the Ed Pawlowski case. Obviously, sending a message. It struck me as something of a hanging judge. I mean, 15 years sounds like a lot of time for somebody that's done what I thought was arguable, at least. Is 15 years seem fair?
15 years is fair because the law says that it's fair. It may seem like a long time, but mortgage fraud and public corruption, two different things, like apples and oranges. Mortgage fraud is going to hurt citizens. They're being defrauded of their money that they don't have. They're losing their homes, perhaps. Public corruption, we vote for our officials, the elected officials. We put our trust in them, unwavering trust that they will do the right things to run a city, township, state in the best interests of the people that live there. And when that trust gets violated, that's a serious violation.
It is, but like Buddy Cianci, he ended up getting reelected while the active case was going on. I mean,
could happen. Could happen.
Yeah.
But it's the people's choice.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how much of an example, you know, of a message that was sent, because, we've got a president who I would think you'd want to make an example of. The president of the United States shouldn't be thought of as unconstitutionally powerful and autocratic. And we've got a guy who seems to be guilty of an awful lot of things, and yet Mueller said he's not prosecutable. Is that, you agree with that? Is that your assessment of the law?
Well, yes. And I think most constitutional scholars, and since I'm teaching constitutional law this semester at DeSales, I'm going to throw myself in that mix, would say that a sitting president cannot be indicted, period. no matter what they do.
And it's that black and white? There's no
it's that black and white
in there?
And here's where it comes into black and white. The Constitution says if the president, for committing treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors, and gets caught for it, impeachment is the remedy, not indictment.
And impeachment is a political decision. Obviously, you've got a divided Congress. You got one side that is run by Democrats, the other side by Republicans, who are pretty dug in on everything. So the punishment would be to get your caucus thrown out of the majority. But shouldn't there be something that rises above? Well, I guess that would be the Supreme Court. Right? I mean,
well, the Supreme Court's not going to do anything unless they have a case before them. I mean, the Supreme Court may say, well, we don't like the way this president's operating. Well, guess what? Tough luck. Your job is to interpret the law when you have a case. Supreme Court does not give out advisory opinions. Mm-hmm. And they won't get involved with political questions either. If it's another branch of government, Congress or the executive branch, then that's who controls, not the Supreme Court. And I'll tell you that the president has a lot of inherent executive powers under the Constitution. And if he did something wrong, if he obstructed justice, as
which
Mueller kind of says, could have done, but we couldn't prove it, guess what? As soon as he's not president anymore, you can go after him and charge him with a crime.
And you can go after him for the things he did as president.
Well, it has to be a crime. You can't go after the president for doing things that you disagree with or that you can't understand. Because if he has the constitutional power to do it, then you cannot go after him at any time. So let's say, for instance, President Trump pardons a mass murderer and the country goes crazy. Like, what are you doing, President Trump? You're pardoning this mass murderer. That's outrageous. You should be out of office. Well, guess what? The Constitution gives the president the pardon power, unlimited pardon power. If you want to change the Constitution, go amend it. It ain't easy.
So you haven't been teaching real long, so maybe this isn't a fair question, but do you see young people? I mean, I teach at Lehigh. Well, I didn't until this semester. Do you see young people as being jaded by what they're watching? Do you see them as being charged up by what they're watching? I mean, it seems to me that there's just so much for sale and so many things that are being just, you know, people thumbing their nose at convention. What are young people thinking these days? Do you get a sense of that?
Yes. I've been teaching for 8 years now, and I can tell you what they're thinking is about what's next on social media, Instagram, who's texting them, what's going on their social media sites. They're not thinking about the president. They're not thinking about the Constitution. They're not thinking about our government. They're thinking about, what did so-and-so have for dinner, and are they going to send me a picture of it?
Huh. So where do we go from here? I mean, you're inherently, I think, an optimistic kind of guy. You seem to be. Where does this go? I mean, it just, you know, climate change scares the hell out of me. I mean, the species is at risk here. Are you motivated to try to fix that by teaching? What is your reason for being in the classroom?
Well, that's my reason. My reason is so that I can help influence students to pay attention to things that are important about what's going on in the world, like climate change, and not worry so much about who went to what restaurant or what's the next, you know, greatest video game that they should be watching. I want them to learn about the Constitution. I want them to know about ethics and criminal justice and how discretion plays a role in it. And I want them to think about these things. And that's why I'm in the classroom, because I think if people don't go into the classroom, we're headed for a bad place.
I think we're in a bad place. I mean, you know, I worry about so much of the stuff as everybody I think knows, I have Parkinson's. I'm not going to be able to do this work for that much longer, and it just drives me nuts that I won't be able to be in that fray like I've been for 30, almost 40 years. I mean, does the country, I mean, I don't even see how this gets corrected. Does it have to be some kind of a calamity that causes us to finally come together? Or
I don't know. Do we need more calamities? Let's see. We've had, in the past month, 3 mass shootings, including this past weekend, where just a police car stop resulted in a guy shooting and killing 5 people and wounding over 20.
I think they're up to 6.
6 people.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is going on in this country? Mass shootings, they're not even on the front page anymore.
Neil Heaver is the producer of the show, and I always want to thank Neil. But Neil is saying it's 7 now. 7 are now dead. So, okay, so, you know, it used to be, I liked the good old days when my father forced me to shut up and listen to the news at night. And, you know, we were watching Huntley Brinkley. Plenty of people were watching Cronkite. I don't remember who the ABC News guy was. Was it, it wasn't as before Peter Jennings, but,
yeah.
You know, we had 3 news outlets on television.
Right.
We had 1 newspaper, maybe 2 in town. And, you know, the news presented the facts, at least, you know, differently than they do now. I mean, everything's biased in one direction or another. And you can find stuff on the internet that'll justify anything, including mass shootings. So how do you have any perspective on anything the FBI and federal prosecutors might be doing to look at the conspiratorial nature of this stuff? I mean, because if they're reading stuff on the internet about, you know, that glorifies the Charlottesville incident in Virginia, and then they, you know, take their weapons and go out and, you know, fire into a crowd, is there a RICO thing there? Is there anything the federal government has that they can do on this?
Well, they have federal gun laws. There's not a lot. You know, we can't use the racketeering statute to necessarily go after a mass murderer that disagrees. Look at who our mass murderers are. People get fired from a job, they go back to the job site and shoot it up. People at school have issues with teachers or think the school's not teaching them the right things, they go back to school and they shoot it up. There's not a lot of laws that are going to be that helpful other than some type of gun control. And then you have the people who are the Second Amendment people saying, we have a right to carry guns, which, you know, as I told my class today, the Supreme Court never said people have a right to carry guns. The only thing the Supreme Court has said about guns is you have a right to own a firearm in your home, a handgun, in your home for self-protection. That's all. And they've never said it's an unlimited right to carry any gun anywhere, anytime.
So why can't we use RICO on this? RICO is
a statute that was originally came about in the 60s to go after
Capone and
the mafia,
right?
Basically,
right.
And so it's the racketeer influenced and corrupt organizations. It's basically to go after organizations, conspiracies, and gangs. These mass shooters, they don't know each other. There's not a group. It's usually one shooter on their own.
They seem sort of lone wolfish.
So,
but at the same time, they are connecting into these internet sources that are, you know, stoking the fire. I mean,
you're right. So there's an interesting question, Alan. It's the internet sources that are stoking these people to go out and commit mass murder. So we should just take that stuff off the internet, right? And so there wouldn't be as many killings.
Well, then you've got First Amendment issues.
Then you've got First Amendment issues. Isn't this a great country? I can say anything almost that I want, and that's my free speech right.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, that just has...
Rock in a hard place.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the people, I mean, you probably read some of the local blogs and some of the vicious stuff that's said there, and they do it under the cloak of anonymity. You know, they have their web, their nom de web.
Right.
You know, and they say, I mean, I was called an evil false prophet. I thought that was such a great diss. I was going to use it as the title of my book, Confessions of an Evil False Prophet. Nobody liked the title. I thought it would get people's attention. But, you know, it's that the hate and the, I think, isolation brought on in part by the internet. You know, I think a lot of the people that are making these trolling kinds of comments are probably sitting in their parents' basement with their pajamas on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, getting their jollies off the internet and contributing to that.
Well, look, we all love smartphones. We all love the internet because it gives us an opportunity, number one, to look at things we would never look at if people were watching
right.
us. And number two, to say things that we would never say to a person's face. Do it electronically now.
Yeah.
It's easy.
You know, they when these mass shootings occur, I think you probably know, the stock prices of the manufacturers of the weapons go up.
Right.
Now, I think we ought to put 100% tax on profits that are earned following these shootings. You know, every nickel that you make off of that mass shooting, we're going to take from you. I mean, undoubtedly, the Congress isn't going to agree to that anytime soon or any more than they would any of the other, you know, smart things that I think we could do as a country. You're still listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. My guest is Seth Weber. We have a little bit of time before we go into the next break. Okay, what's up with you retiring? Well, I mean, if you like doing the law enforcement thing, you are obviously successful. I appreciated your work. Why did you get out?
You know, I loved my job. I couldn't believe that I was an assistant U.S. attorney representing citizens in 8 counties surrounding the Lehigh Valley and Philadelphia in federal court, going before federal judges, protecting victims of crimes, and they paid me for it. It was the greatest job in the world. But they had this early retirement program, which makes sense for the federal government. You pay a person so much money, and you want to give them an opportunity to retire so you could hire somebody else, take their place, and pay them less.
Right.
So they had this early retirement, and I thought, well, I'm at a certain age. If you ever want to do anything else in life, now may be a good time to do that. And I thought, I would like to teach, and the timing was right.
You know, this is off the topic, but how do they know we're good teachers? You know, I mean,
That's an interesting question. Yeah.
I mean, I got great student evaluations, but I could have been getting great evaluations because I made the class easy. I mean, in fact, the first class I would say to them, you know, my goal is for you to leave here saying it was an easy class, but you learned a lot, you know, and they probably like that.
And
know?
Course evaluations, by the way, I could tell you both at DeSales and Villanova, the schools take those very seriously. So if you're not a good teacher, meaning you're not a good communicator, you cancel a lot of classes, you don't show up on time, you're gonna get let go. You know, so if you're easy, they may say that. But I'll tell you what, students today, I've had criticisms that this class was too easy. He went over this stuff. He could have done it in a week. He took 3 weeks. So it's a fine line.
Yeah, that's off topic. Yeah. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. My guest tonight is Seth Weber. We're going to talk about gangs in a minute. Hope you stick around after the break.
The many choices and real voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
So, welcome back. Seth, did you get a haircut because of your federal prosecutor's job?
I did. I did.
Yeah, we all have to give in at some point, right? You know, while you were a prosecutor, and I remember, you know, because you and I spent a lot of time together and a couple of other guys. I mean, there was a whole task force that the U.S. attorney had on predatory lending. It eventually went away because the money dried up, as I mentioned earlier in the show. But I remember at the time, a Lancaster assistant U.S. attorney turned up absent, just vanished. I don't know if that incident was ever prosecuted or dealt with in any way. Did you ever feel scared in the work you did? I mean, because you were up against some pretty nasty characters.
Right. So, you know, mostly in the drug cases, sometimes you'd get threats and the U.S. Marshals would investigate or the FBI would investigate. I was investigating a Lehigh Valley lawyer for criminal activity, and they were recording his conversations through another witness that was cooperating, and I got threatened on tape by this lawyer.
That lawyer was eventually found guilty, was he not?
Yes, he was.
So it's public information.
It is public.
That would be John Caroli.
That would be John Caroli.
Yeah. Well, he was a big NRA member, and so I would have taken that threat seriously.
We took it seriously. The FBI investigated it and was watching and guarding me for a period of time.
Do you have a family? Are you married? Do you have kids?
Yes. Yes to both.
And how old were the kids at the time?
Young children.
Did they know about the threat?
They probably did not. My wife certainly knew about
it. Ignorance is bliss?
Yeah.
Was your wife freaked out?
A little bit. But she assumed that I would be protected by the law enforcement agencies.
So how did you deal with it? Did you, I mean, frankly, if it were me, I'd have been proud that somebody was after me.
Well, yeah, and the issue is, you know, what can you do? You never know when it's going to happen. So you just be aware of your surroundings and try to take some extra precautions, that's all.
And were there other incidents besides the one I mentioned in Lancaster that would have given you cause for special, or did you, by, you know, all that, were you always on special guard?
I was always on guard. I was on particularly special guard for that threat. And then there was a threat one day in a courtroom of a guy that got sentenced, and, you know, he makes the motion like to, you know, you're going to get it and slash your throat. And, you know, so that took some extra efforts too.
You know, before you guys finally prosecuted the case and I was involved, and I was everywhere trying to get attention for it, and I made no attempt to you know, not mention names. I named names the whole thing. I was showing settlement sheets. And when you guys put them away, I thought, oh boy, what happens when they get out? I have not had any contact with these people. I'm glad for it. But, you know, it would seem to me that, you know, people get in that kind of trouble, you would have much less reason to be careful because you know, so I never really got too freaked out about it, but it crossed my mind more than once. And but I guess you don't see that often, though.
No,
right?
Particularly in white collar crime, there is honor among thieves. You know, they were doing something wrong, they got caught. Okay, you did your job, they did theirs, they went to jail. Fine, let's all move on.
So what's with lawyers?
What is with lawyers?
I mean, lawyers are supposed to be people who are experts in the law. And you would think that you'd go into the law to respect it, and yet lawyers seem to be among the best at not adhering to those things. I mean, do you think people go into it to beat the system, to learn how to beat the system? And what's with dirty lawyers?
What's with dirty lawyers? Well, I've prosecuted as a former assistant U.S. attorney. Three lawyers in the Lehigh Valley, two of whom stole money from clients, and one of whom just was not paying taxes and was trying to collect money through a fraudulent scheme. And it boggled my mind. These are lawyers that are supposed to know the law, obey the law, enforce the law for people, and yet they were violating the law. And my feeling was, shame on them. And if I catch them, then I'd go after them.
And they would certainly lose their law license, wouldn't they?
Well, that's up to the disciplinary board, but we always recommended, the U.S. Attorney's Office, once you were convicted of a felony, always recommended that a lawyer lose their license.
Okay, so let's fantasize, at least in my own mind for a minute, that I got elected to the United States Congress. And I became the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and I pushed you to be appointed as Attorney General of the United States. What changes would you make? What would you do differently? What would you are there issues that you would go after?
Well, the issues that are the obvious ones an attorney general can go after. I mean, the attorney general is the highest law enforcement officer in the United States. So the attorney general runs and is in charge of every single enforcement branch, FBI, DEA, ATF, EPA. The attorney general has the last word on what the enforcement mechanism is going to be. So I would go after the problems that are the most pressing ones in the country.
So, Attorney General Barr strikes me as being a political hack. And he strikes me as one who's covering for the president, not going after him. And it doesn't surprise me, really, because he was appointed by the president. So I've never understood the dynamic between an attorney general having responsibility for upholding the law, but being a political appointee and having ideological positions and political allies that would want him to do something different, or his own instincts might have him do something different. So how is it that we make that work? I mean, and does it work even?
Well, generally it works. Just because a person is appointed by a president of a particular party doesn't mean that the attorney general is going to follow every single step that the president says. The attorney general is going to follow the Constitution and the federal laws, and that's it. Now, it's not the attorney general's job to go after the president. The attorney general's job is to enforce the federal law and the Constitution.
And if the president is the one who's committing the problems, why wouldn't we go after him like we would anybody else?
Because the Constitution says the remedy is impeachment, not indictment.
Well, even getting to the point of impeachment, wouldn't you want to exhaust all the issues that are going on there and then turn that report over to the Congress and with all of it laying out in plain view?
I mean, do that, although people would say that's a waste of taxpayer money. Why should the FBI, let's say, investigate a president for commission of a high crime and misdemeanor when the Congress is going to set up a committee to do the exact same thing? And the Congress has subpoena power and witness power to bring witnesses and subpoena documents before Congress. So why do it twice?
Comey, Mueller, there have been almost a parade of, I'm trying to think of some of the other names, people who have been in responsible positions for investigation or, protecting the Constitution, if you will, and have been escorted out and nothing's happened. Nothing seems to happen. I guess it's just that political. How does Mueller have the credibility that he's got, but then pass on the question of whether the president committed crimes? I mean, he's not going to be the prosecutor, but he could at least say, yep, we saw it, here it is. He didn't go that far. He basically sort of danced around it and kind of hinted at it, but he never really said that this guy is in violation.
So if he said that, and if there's that suggestion that there may have been obstruction, but we can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, Mueller's job is just to bring it to the attention of the people, the Congress. And he's not to prosecute it. So, Mueller did his job by making us aware of what he did find, what he didn't find, and what he found but would not be able to be proved by sufficient evidence. Then it goes to somebody else. No one else has picked up that Mueller ball.
Well, I think the Democrats have tried to make something of it, but that gets, that gets tainted by accusations of politics, too. Who was the attorney general when Nixon was into his stuff? Was it John Mitchell?
Yes, he was
right
in the Watergate, right.
Do you know enough about Watergate to be able to compare the seriousness of the crime to the two administrations, the Nixon? I mean, Nixon and Trump strike me as being similar in so many different ways. They're just their personality and all. They're the kind of you know, what's the word? Psychosis isn't the word, but I mean, there's something there between the two that just strikes me as being a mirror on history.
They are similar, and you know, in personalities. But, you know, remember Nixon and Watergate, that was a crime, period. It was burglary. It was conspiracy. You could prosecute those things. And if the president knew about it and was conspiratorial in that, well, that would warrant impeachment. Trump, there's allegations he obstructed justice by firing Comey. But you know what? The president has constitutional power to hire and fire government public officials.
So you're defending a system that I think is hard to defend. Where does this all lead us? I mean, where does this go? I mean, if we've even now tainted the highest law enforcement office in the land in some form or another, who do people trust anymore? What institutions are safe? The Catholic Church has got itself in all kinds of trouble. The Boy Scouts, for crying out loud. I mean, you can't get more, you know, middle of the road in this country than the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts of America. And yet they've tainted themselves. I mean, where does this all go?
It's a scary thought. And, you know, it's in a good measure in the hands of the people, because we have another election coming up.
Right.
And are they going to re-vote for President Trump another 4 years? Or are they going to say, that's enough, we want a Democrat just to be do something different? It's up to the people. They're going to decide.
Are you allowed to talk about your own political persuasion? I mean, where are you? You are. I've never been able to figure out. Are you Republican or Democrat? Are you allowed to say
I'm registered Republican.
Registered Republican. Do you consider yourself a Trump supporter?
You know, I have my days. I have my days.
Well, we used to be friends.
But, you know, he's done some good things. And, you
really?
Know, I just
like
saw
what?
On, well, on social media, he just signed an executive order completely wiping out all veterans' college loans. You don't have to pay it back if you are a veteran. It's a
that's
great
that's
thing.
That's cool.
And I saw it on social
that's
media.
True.
But
I'll
you know
you
where
that.
I didn't see it? I didn't see it in the newspapers. I didn't see it on the televised news.
Yeah.
Nothing. Because that's the problem. You know, we always hear about the things that you go, he did what? But you never hear about the things that he does good.
Yeah. And well, I'll give you that one. I'm trying to think of another one. There's got to be another one somewhere along the line. Do you have any regrets as in the work that you did as a federal prosecutor?
No, I have no regrets.
What about, I mean, did people get away that you think you could have done a better job on? I mean, was there any time where you thought you were fallible? I mean, I've made so many mistakes in my time. It's
sure.
It's embarrassing.
Sure. There's times when I'm fallible and I should have done something that I didn't do. There are times, which was easy for a prosecutor, to blame the jury. How could you find this person not guilty with all the evidence we gave you?
Yeah.
But that's the jury system. And you have to believe in the system. It's not a perfect system, but it's a pretty good system.
Yeah. Let's talk about Allentown's problem with the gangs. You know, if I was J.B. Riley, I would be totally freaked out. I mean, that guy has invested an enormous amount of energy into some $600 million in real estate development, done a phenomenal job. And, you know, all you need is for the news to report another shooting, and you can just hear the for sale signs being pounded into people's front yards. What do you do? I mean, have gangs ever been treated as a federal law enforcement issue?
Yes, they have. In fact, me and John Gallagher from the U.S. Attorney's Office both prosecuted a gang called the Latin Kings. Now, that's a national gang.
Right.
Every state has, or most of the states, have a branch. They're actually called tribes of the Latin Kings. And what we have to do is, you don't prosecute one or two. We indicted the entire Bethlehem Sun tribe, 37 or so defendants.
You did that?
All at once. Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. We took out the entire Bethlehem Sun tribe of the Latin King gang.
But everything they did was below the, you know, the law, right? So how do you even, what's the institution? What
guns? There's drugs. There's
you
know,
took
loan
them out
sharking.
Individually, but
we took them out all at once at the same time. One indictment, 37 defendants. You get 200 law enforcement officials to go out and do the raids, and they're all locked up at one time.
You're listening. I keep forgetting to do this. You're listening to WDIY Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest tonight is Seth Weber, friend and former federal prosecutor and professor of law at DeSales University. By the way, the new president's a good guy, isn't he?
Of the school, Father Greenfield.
Yeah,
the best.
Yeah. Yeah, I met him last week for the first time. He was instantly on, you know, in my like column.
Approachable and personable.
Yeah. So
and bright.
Do you have? So you got it in Bethlehem. I think my impression is that the Bethlehem situation is much, much better than the Allentown situation. We're working on the next six-year redevelopment project that we're doing in Allentown, and it's looking like we're going to go after the whole gang issue pretty aggressively. I met with a gang member a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him if he was offered a job teaching, trying to talk kids in the neighborhood out of joining a gang, would you take it? He said he would. I said, do you think the other gangs would too? He said, yeah. Sounds like we've got an easy solution to this problem.
It's either an easy solution or he talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk.
Yeah. He struck me as a pretty bright guy. And, I mean, you know, by all the stereotypes, you figure he was probably a gang member, you know, had a do-rag and all that kind of stuff. But,
well, you know, he's either a member of the Blood or the Latin Kings or the Crips. And
yeah.
They're here. They're just here. And you have to take the whole group out. And by the way, that said, there's still Latin Kings now back in Bethlehem. They just get new members. Huh. I took out an entire gang in Allentown, a drug gang, the 2ND gang, Second Street gang. I think I had 20 drug gang members in that indictment.
Wow.
And then I read that another assistant U.S. attorney just indicted 2ND. And I went and said, I already indicted them. Nah, that was the older ones. Then younger ones came in. Same gang, same stuff.
The gang member I met with was basically dissing the local gang, saying that these guys can't shoot. You know, there was 29 bullets shot and only two actually hit somebody, and they were like on the leg and the hand type of thing.
Right.
So he was dismissing them as serious gang members, calling them amateurs. It was pretty interesting to talk to this guy. And I think we're going to spend some time working with him and seeing if we can get anywhere with it. I recognize that you got to be careful in these kinds of situations, but it's pretty tempting to try to take that on. What the hell, I'm running out of time in my career anyway. I might as well take on something.
You could give it a shot. Just remember, they're gang members. It's like tigers.
Yeah.
You can have a really sweet tiger. You could have a tiger as a pet in your home.
Still a tiger.
It's still a tiger, and it's still going to do what tigers do.
Yeah.
Same thing with gang members.
Well, you're listening to the Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. This is Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Seth Weber, my guest tonight, federal prosecutor, former board member of WDIY, I found out. So thanks for coming back into the studio and for the good work you do, Seth. I had a great time working with you. I thought you were an honorable guy.
And thanks for inviting me back to WDIY, where it's their 25th
anniversary.
Right.
And over there at the control panel is Neil Heaver, one of the guys that made it all possible. So way to go, Neil.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next
time. Happy birthday, WDIY.